Thinking about the sermon today, there are a couple of things that influenced the way that I determined to speak today, the message that I decided to give to you. One is coming back from Jamaica, a lot of comments from various people, both there and back here, about the fact that we have numerous church groups in Jamaica, all with virtually identical doctrinal beliefs, not very much different at all in the doctrinal beliefs, all within about 2 miles of each other, keeping the feast as we were keeping the feast. Some of the people came and kept part of the time with us, and I imagine some of our people went and kept part of the time with some of them. Church of God Worldwide Association was close by. I don't know exactly. I mean, everybody else was saying how far it is to this, where this group is, and how far it is to where that. I didn't know any of the geography. I should have had Jackson there to tell me about the geography. He's doing really quite well in studying some geography with Armin. Armin got the world map out and told Jackson the places where he's been, and Jackson could identify virtually all of those places except the ones in Africa. He couldn't really point out the ones in Africa, so Armin was showing him those as well. But here we had these various groups in Jamaica, Church of God Worldwide Association, not far away, Living, not far away. And surprised me, but there's a very substantial, probably the biggest group in Jamaica keeping the feast was Church of International, Church of God International, CGI. And that's a kind of a remnant after Ted Armstrong has been dead for some time now. They still continue and keep the feast of Tabernacles. It's apparently the biggest group on the island, and they continue to keep the Feast of Tabernacles there. And I'm confident they have the same general doctrinal beliefs that we have. You could even probably think about other groups there. Seventh-day Adventists are big in the islands, I know. And they are at least weekly Sabbath keepers. They kind of have a kind of a week manifestation of keeping the Sabbath day. All legitimate, to some extent, manifestations of God's church. And yet, even though we're all there together, all believe the same things, we can't meet together. And like as not, oftentimes, there's an attitude of conflict between different groups. We are, and I would submit to you, based on what I'm going to cover today in the Bible, we will continue to be a church in conflict. Here's a question. The question involves unity. Does God want unity among those branches of his true church? And I submit to you, they all are branches of his true church. We don't take an exclusivist attitude toward that. Does God want unity among those branches of his church? Ephesians chapter 4 and verse 3 states, here Paul is writing to the church in Ephesus, which was essentially a Gentile church, not that that's important for this message. Paul says, endeavoring to keep the unity of the Spirit in the bond of peace. So Paul is saying that one of our objectives should be to have a unity of the Spirit in a bond of peace. He says there is one body, one Spirit, even as you are called in one hope of your calling. Now, the word one pops up repeatedly in that verse, inferring that we are to be unified. And yet, we aren't. We aren't. Question. Are we capable of unity? We all have the same, we all understand the same truth of God, but we are not unified. Are we capable of unity? And for what reason are we not unified? Is there something else which is at play which keeps us from being unified? Well, I'd say some of both of those. You know, I think partly we're not spiritual enough, but also there are some other things that are at play. I would say one of the things to keep in mind is the Boy Scout motto. Do you know the Boy Scout motto? Hazel does. Do you, Natasha? Oh, well, that's not fair. Okay, well, they have pioneers in the Soviet Union. It was something like Scouts, but they had these summer camps and so forth where all of the young people went, and it was kind of indoctrination training. I think more indoctrination than the Boy Scouts were, although you could probably make an argument for the fact that there was indoctrination involved in that too. Boy Scout motto is be prepared. Be prepared. Why do I say it'd be a good idea to keep the Boy Scout motto in mind? Because I am confident that we're going to need to be prepared, because that there will be more conflict to come. And why do I say, for Armin, we had a discussion about this. He says, we never learn. History is something that has to be repeated by every generation. And through the history of the church, this has happened over and over for 2,000 years. You're right, Armin. You're right. This has happened over and over for 2,000 years. The church has been in conflict over the same general issues. What about biblical wisdom? Do we have some wisdom which comes from the Bible, which gives us a direction about how we should navigate such stormy waters as we have had, and which I am prophesying to you, we will continue to have? This will be an expository sermon. We have two different kinds of sermons. We have topical sermons, and we have expository sermons. Topical sermons take a topic and follow it around through the various places you will find it in the Bible. Expository sermons take a certain segment of the Bible, stick primarily with that segment, and try to shine light on that section of Scripture without looking for topics. Now, I say it's expository because it is going to primarily deal with one place in the Bible. And that place gives us instructions in regard to the situation that we have had for 2,000 years in the church. No sermon is completely, well, maybe some are. No sermon is probably completely expository or completely topical, but this one will be primarily an expository sermon. The section of the Bible I'm talking about is 1 John chapter 4, What I want to do is shine in this sermon, SPS statement, to shine light on 1 John 4 as it relates to our church in conflict. John starts this chapter by saying, be skeptical. Now, if we want to have unity, that's probably not the best way to approach unity, is it? Every time something comes up, if you're skeptical. But here's the question I would propose to you in that regard. How much does God want unity? How much does He want unity? You know, if He wants unity, is He willing to sacrifice truth in order to have unity? See? And if we can't have unity with truth, then I have to surmise that as far as God is concerned, this unity is preferable to having a doctrinal error or that which is not true in His church. So John begins 1 John chapter 4, warning us that we are to be skeptical. And here he's writing to a church which has obviously had a lot of the same problems that we have had. And that's the reason I bring it up in relationship to what I mentioned as far as the Feast of Tabernacles. I suppose it would be possible to walk virtually to every one of those feast sites from the feast site where we were staying. And who knows how many people in total there. We had about 260, 270. And I think we were probably the single biggest group with the possible exception of Church of God International, which apparently they don't have many people from outside the island come there, but they have that many members on the island. And so, here's what John says at the start of 1 John chapter 4. Beloved, watch it. Do not believe every spirit, but try the spirit. Whether they are of God. Now, it immediately says something to us, doesn't it? In the church, and this is a true church, John writes to them, God had it put into the Bible and memorialized in a book to be passed down to us. Try the spirits. Why do we have to try the spirits? Because we cannot be sure that all of the spirits that we find inside the church are appropriate spirits. Whether they are of God, implications, some are, some aren't. It's not an implication, it's a flat statement, isn't it? It's a bold statement. Implication, something you have to look at and think about and decide about as a result of that. This is a definite statement. Whether they are of God, some are, some aren't, because many false prophets are gone out into the world. Now, I don't know. This is maybe, I don't know how long it was after Christ's death that John wrote this. Could have been 10 years, could have been 20 years. I didn't research that. I probably should have looked at it. But in some period of time after Christ's death, here, while people were still alive who knew Christ, he's saying many false prophets have gone out into the world. And where are those false prophets being manifested? Inside the church. Those are the ones John's concerned about. So I guess I'd say to you, as I stand here in front of you and speak to you, John said, be skeptical. Don't accept everything that anybody has to say. You better look at me. Because the responsibility is on you. We talked about this sword of the Spirit and the skillful use of the sword of the Spirit in the sermonette. You can look at me and you've got to decide, am I, what spirit of what spirit am I when I speak to you? And so I advise you to be skeptical of me. And I know that we've had a lot of ministers in this area that half of them probably proved to be false in the ways that we're talking about. So be skeptical. Christ himself told us that we are to be skeptical. This is this is really the beginning of the book of Revelation, if we want to look at it, the four horsemen that go out. What's the first horseman? Matthew 24. Let's read the first five verses there. Christ went out of the temple, and the disciples were impressed by all of the buildings that were being built around the temple. There was great construction going on at the time. And the construction was magnificent. And they were so impressed by it. He went out and departed the temple. His disciples came to him to show him the buildings of the temple. These buildings were surrounding the temple. You can read about them in various commentaries and literature. And Christ said, hey, don't be so impressed. That's what he said to them. Don't be so impressed by these buildings. You see all of these things? They're not going to last. Truly, I say to you, there's not going to be one stone left upon another that shall not be thrown down. And so they walked in from the temple. There's a valley. And I guess it's on the east side of the Temple Mount, the valley. Then you go up a hillside to the Mount of Olives. And it says, he went up, verse 3, to the Mount of Olives. Disciples came to him, and they sat down with him privately, saying, tell us more. Tell us more about these things. When shall these things be? What shall be the sign of your coming and of the end of the cosmos, the age? It's a continuing thing I have to check about whenever I'm talking to somebody in another part of the world. What does their Bible say about this question? Because in the English, people think that the Bible is talking about the end of the world, the real end of the world, the destruction of the planet, or at least the desolation of the planet to such an extent that no life will be left alive. At least no human life left alive. That's what they think is meant here by this question. But it's not. Most of the other languages that I encounter, they don't translate it this way. They translate it the end of the age. And when an age ends, another age begins. You know, we had people historically tell us we had the Iron Age and the Bronze Age and these different ages that came along. Well, that's what this is saying. What will be the end of this age? When this age ends, what begins is the kingdom of God. The end of this age, which was for 6,000 years, marks the beginning of the kingdom of God, which will then first last for 1,000 years. And he gave them some answers. Take heed that no man deceive you. talking about deception. Many shall come in my name, saying that I am Christ, and shall deceive many. Armed with just that piece of information, we should be skeptical about what we hear. We really have an obligation to be able to use the sword of the Spirit skillfully to determine those things. And none of us are perfect in that regard. We're all learning. But it's our responsibility as God has given it to us. So John says, don't believe every spirit, but he says to do something else. Try the spirits. How do we try spirits? Now, that's not talking about drinking some Jack Daniels and see what the effect is. But try the spirits, whether these spirits are of God, because, as Christ said would happen, many false prophets are gone out into the world. If we're going to be able to try the spirits, we have to have some methodology, don't we, in order to try them. We can think about how do we try and test various things. Now, I thought about this as something that we test for, and it's very important that we get this right physically. We test our water, don't we? And we test that water to see that it's drinkable. If it isn't drinkable, big problem. And why is water, maybe testing water, good? Because, well, water is a symbol of what? God's Holy Spirit, isn't it? Yet there is water that's unclean around. There's clean water and there's unclean water. And we can be subjected to both. We can be subjected to both. When Brian and I were taking chemistry together at Corning Community College, we did some testing on drinking water. Well, typically, people who have drinking water that they won't test it, they take it to the testing lab. Friend Lab was one that was close by. Take your drinking water there and have it tested to see if it is drinkable. And they test it for such things as maybe whether there's organic material in it or not. If there's organic material in it, you want to be very, very careful about that. We test water to see if there's bacteria in it, especially the bacteria that we worry about in drinking water is E. coli. It's an intestinal bacteria. If animals have been around your well and, you know, the residue from their feces gets down into the water, it'll be carrying E. coli into your water. And if you drink that water, you can get very sick. Very sick. There's quantitative and qualitative testing that's done. Well, John instructs us that we must expect false doctrines, know that there are testing procedures to determine that which is true and that which is false. We are to use them to identify the undesirable, and not just the undesirable, but also to identify that which is desirable, you know? We have to drink water, don't we? We can't survive if we don't drink water. We have to have clean water. And so we have to test the water and determine whether or not it's drinkable. Spiritually speaking, I would think it's a very succinct analogy. Spiritually, we must have clean water. If we're going to survive spiritually, it gives us life. Without it, we don't have it. We are to accept the appropriate spirits and to reject the inappropriate. So John says, don't believe every spirit. Don't have to test for them. Try the spirits, whether they are of God, because many false prophets are gone out into the world. Many doesn't mean a few, by the way. Many means many. There are a lot of them. And why do we find so many fractures into the church where the essential doctrine that we understand is the same? Because maybe it's partly because of what John says here. Many false prophets have gone out into the world. So it's plural. He uses adjective nouns and pronouns, all of them, in a plural way. He says every. He says spirits. He says they. And he says many. But then he directly addresses a single spirit here in this chapter in 1 John chapter 4. But he does talk about testing procedures for identifying some other false prophets. Before we get through, I'll show you that he also identifies two other ways to test for unclean spirits. I would just say that as long as we have members who are bringing ungodly spirits into the church, and we have the obligation, as long as we have the obligation to test and try those, and we have people who are bringing them in, we are going to continue to have conflict. And I would say our instruction is we have to reject them. And so, while God may ultimately bring about unity, as long as he's got the situation in the church going as it is, probably there's not going to be unity until such time as God steps in. And I don't think, by the way, any organization is perfect. I mean, of course, except us. No, we're not perfect either. I don't think any organization is perfect. And yet, I think some are convinced that they are. Some are convinced that they are. And I think it's a great idolatry for them to say that they are so wonderful that They shouldn't associate with anybody else. I don't throw them out as reject them as being part of God's church either, but I think it's a problem that they have. We have our problems. I'm sure I would say no group is perfect and no organization is perfect. But here's some proofs, easy proofs, I would say. Try the spirits. Prove them. Prove those which are acceptable and those which are not acceptable. Some testing of the spirits is quite easy. It's like shooting fish in a barrel. I've never done that. Maybe it's not as easy as this idiomatic expression implies that it is. You can shoot fish in a barrel. Well, it sounds like it ought to be easy, doesn't it? I don't know if it is. We have an idiomatic expression that makes us think it is. And some of the tests for water are easy. The E. coli test is probably quite an easy test. You shine light and look through a microscope and you can probably see it as a result of that. Finding other problems in your drinking water, is not so easy. If you're going to look for pesticides in your drinking water, that's a very difficult test. Very difficult test. And most of the time that isn't tested for, you know, in drinking water. Because you have to know which pesticide you're looking for or you won't find it. The test is very specific. So there's some easy tests and there's some hard tests. Here's one that John addresses. It's the one he basically addresses in this chapter. Directly. He directly addresses this one. But he doesn't say it's the only one. Remember, we talked about plural. Many have gone out. Spirits, plural, they, and every. So he's addressing one here, but he's not excluding a lot of other things that could go on in the church. 1 John chapter 4, verse 2. Hereby we know the Spirit of God. Every spirit, he said, try the Spirit. Verse 2, he says, hereby we know the Spirit of God. Every spirit that confesses that Jesus Christ is come in the flesh is of God. And every spirit that does not confess Jesus Christ is come in the flesh is not of God. This is that spirit of Antichrist, where have you ever heard that it should come? Even now, it is already in the world. It's a great spirit of Antichrist talking about. I don't think that this is a spirit that we encounter too much here in the United States. Because I can go to the Protestant church, and as far as I know, I can go to the Catholic church, and they will say Christ is God in the flesh. They confess that Christ is God, and he's come in the flesh. And so, by that standard, we don't see that very much here. There's a man in Estonia who wrote a book by the name of Leo Kargarov. He wrote a book about the truth of God. He had a very excellent book written in Estonia. And then he decided that Christ was not God. At least in part, that's what he decided. I don't know totally what he decided. He's a very likable guy, very, very intellectually smart guy. And he abrogated everything that he said and has taught that Christ was a man, not that he was God. Incarnation is a test here that John is giving. There are two ways that we can look at our incarnation. Number one, God, Christ was only a man, not God. The other one was Christ was never a man. He was always only God. Truth of the matter is, he was both man and God. So you can get it wrong for either of those two reasons. But that's not the only spirit that we need to test. It's not the only spirit we need to test. Could there be, so we can identify this, we can identify E. coli in the drinking water because we found the E. coli and eliminated it from the drinking water with some chlorine, does that mean there are not necessarily going to be other problems that could exist in that drinking water? Of course, there could be. That test in itself is, the test of incarnation, is not in itself totally sufficient. There are other things that have to be determined. And I thought of four things that we need to do in order to try the spirits. We talked about incarnation. But here's four other ones as far as shooting fish in a barrel goes. Deuteronomy chapter 4. Verse 2. Last book of Moses. Moses is ready to kick the bucket, we would say. He's ready to die. And so he has the Israelites together and he gives them instruction at the end of his life. They're going into the promised land. He's not going into the promised land. But here's some of the most important things he has to say to them. Verse 2, there's a lot, we could read a lot more in this chapter than this. You shall not add to the word which I command you, neither shall you diminish anything from it, that you may keep the commandments of the Lord your God which I command you. Now see, lots of times people ask me on these trips, you know, I sit down, you know, it's a wearisome thing, I guess, sit down in the seat of an airplane beside somebody else, and I guess I'm like John Candy, I can't fit in the seat very good, and maybe Steve Martin sitting next to me, or maybe there's another John Candy sitting next to me, two by each other, and this is a problem, of course. But then, I saw this one man from who was coming back home to the States, and so we started having a conversation, and I said, "Well, where are you coming from?" He said, "Well, I'm coming from Mumbai." He looked like somebody from Texas or some place like that. I think it turned out he was from Louisiana. And so immediately I began to think, okay, he's out there drilling for oil and gas in Mumbai. I didn't know there was drilling going on in Mumbai, but I talked to him about, yeah, he's out there drilling and setting up rigs and doing that sort of thing. He'd been there for a certain number of months, and now he's going to be home for a certain time. Then he goes back and does that. So that's it. That was what was going on with him. But then he wanted to know, which is what I'm trying to get to, what am I doing there? I said, well, I go to do church work. Oh. Well, he was positive about it. I mean, he had an attitude where he approved of churches in general. But then he wanted to know more, of course, and this is typically what happens when I get in a conversation. What church? What do you believe? And there are different ways to answer that question, of course, as the conversation proceeds. And I think the best way for me to answer that question as I look at it is to say, our church and the people that I am working with are primitive Christians. Primitive Christians. Now, most people will take the word primitive as being a pejorative or a negative. But then I have a chance to explain to them what it means to be a primitive Christian. That is, we practice Christianity the same as the early New Testament church practiced it. For that reason, we are called primitive. And then it sort of leads into what does it mean to be a contrasting thing, a modern Christian. Modern Christians have changed from the Christianity that was practiced in the early New Testament church. So if I use that one word, I sometimes then have the opportunity to expand on the whole conversation. Some people will, of course, not want to hear anything more once you've said church. And it'll be like Steve Martin, who doesn't want to have any conversation on the airplane. Why do I bring that up? How does that relate to what we're saying? Because we just read Deuteronomy chapter 4 and verse 2, which says, do not add to the things which I have given you, and do not take away from the things which I have given you. You shall not add to the word I command you, neither shall you diminish anything from it. Just keep the commandments of the Lord your God, which I command you. We're coming into the season of the year, which is the biggest single time in which many things have been added into Christianity, which were not there originally. Christmas. It's a big adding too, which is a violation of what it says here, which was not practiced at all by the early New Testament church. Easter is the same, isn't it? Easter and Christmas together, the two great festivals of sun worship. And if you read about what happened with Constantine and how Christianity, first of all, transformed the Sabbath to a day of worship, to a Sunday worship. And then you see how Christianity, the festivals of sun worship, came into Christianity. There has been a great adding to, and a great, as a result, taking away from the Word. That's easy. That's one of the ones that you can treat like shooting fish in a barrel. You're looking for false things that come into the church. If somebody comes in, and it's amazing that they did that in 1994, isn't it? 1994, they came in and said, yeah, you should keep Christmas and you should keep Easter, and we can worship on Sunday instead of on Saturday, and we'll move the Feast of Tabernacles to August because it's too inconvenient to keep during the biblical times. So that's like shooting fish in a barrel. That's what I say. If you see that, it's a no-brainer. It's a no-brainer. That's how you try, that's one way you try the spirits. Another way, try the spirits. Ezekiel 18, verse 4. Ezekiel writes, behold, interesting, by the way, too, to whom Ezekiel writes. He says it's sent to the house of Israel. That's what the book says about itself, that this book was written to the house of Israel. Only by the time Ezekiel wrote the book, the house of Israel had disappeared for 140 years. For that reason, many people say the book is a fraud, because it had the house of Israel was gone for 140 years. And what we understand about the book is prophetic. It was talking about the future. It was talking about a future nation of Israel, which the Western Europeans and the people of the United States are. So that it says it was written to the house of Israel. And that's you and me nationally, but it's particularly you and me having to do with the church. Behold, all souls are mine. As the soul of the Father, also the soul of the Son is mine. Here's a very poignant line which gives us an easy test. Fish in a barrel. The soul that sins, it shall die. So if you're looking for false prophets and false doctrines, anybody who comes in saying anything about heaven, hell, and the immortal soul. They've identified themselves. That's fish in a barrel for sure. Easy to see. Another one, lawlessness. Jude chapter 1 and verse 4. There are certain men who crept in unawares. Who were from old times ordained to this condemnation. Ungodly men who turned the grace of God. What's the goal? Turning the grace of God? What? Well, how do we have our salvation? We have our salvation through the grace of God. But there are men who come in and transform the grace of God into lasciviousness or lawlessness. Because God forgives us, we may sin. And we don't earn our own salvation. Turning the grace of God into lawlessness, or the saying that no need to keep those commandments, especially number 4, you know, the Sabbath day, no need. And denying the only Lord and our Lord Jesus Christ. So that's an easy one too. Fish in a barrel. Here's another easy one, but it's been the most effective one in the last 10 years. You know how long it's been since we really entered into this conflict? At least at a heightened level. It's never ceased entirely, but how long has it been since 1994? 20 years. 20 years since this started. I mean, it hardly seems like it to me. I can hardly imagine that 20 years have passed since, you know, leadership in the church got up and said all of these things. But that was in December of 94, wasn't it? If you count 94 as the first year, this is the 20th. 2013 is the 20th year. Time flies when you're having fun. Here's the one that has been the biggest bugaboo, I think, in the last 5 years, gossip. Again, it ought to be an easy one. It ought to be like shooting fish in a barrel. But the fact of the matter is we're so self-absorbed. I don't mean we, but we in the society as a whole are so self-absorbed that we hardly seem to recognize it sometimes. Gossip. James chapter 1 and verse 26. Here's how one of the ways that you test for the spirits. This is what, number 5? Fifth way that we test for the spirits. If any man among you seems to be religious and does not bridle his tongue, but deceives his own heart, this man's religion is in vain. James chapter 1 and verse 26. We had lots of unbridled tongues going, not only in, you know, the other group, but also in our group. And we were fighting fire with fire, I guess. You know, if we fight fire with fire, I guess both parties get burned up. Not a good thing. So those were all some of the easy tests. Water, a symbol of God's Holy Spirit. John says, test that water and let's see if it is drinkable. And I say, here are 5 easy tests that we have been given. There's still other tests. John gives us 2 other tests here in First John chapter 3 and 4. One of those tests is the test of love. He spends a lot of time here in chapter 3 and chapter 4 talking about love. And even on into chapter 5 talking about love. Now it's in the context of trying the spirits. Trying the spirits. Now let's look at, let's sort of set the understanding at least to a degree here as we look at what he had to say in John 13:34-35. The new commandment, he says, I give you. Love one another. Wasn't a new commandment, was it? That wasn't a new commandment. That was from the Old Testament, that we are to love one another. But he says it's a new commandment that I give you. What was new about it? What he said next. As I have loved you. A different level, a different depth of love that was being talked about here. It wasn't the level and the depth of love that the old commandment, the Old Testament talked about. Love was to not do certain things to your, neighbor. But here in the New Testament, part of the difference in New Testament Christianity and the Old Testament nation of Israel is that the requirements, instead of just being physical requirements, as they were in the Old Testament, became spiritual in the New Testament. It took more to meet the standards that were being talked about in the New Testament. The love of the New Testament was quite a bit advanced beyond the love that was shown in the Old Testament. John 13:34, new commandment I give you, love one another as I have loved you, as I have loved you. As I have loved you. That's new? You bet it's new. By this shall all men know that you are my disciples if you have love for one another. Now, whenever we start talking about love, the first thing I think of that we have to really consider is the definition of what love is. The biblical definition of love. Because we all have our societal definitions of love, don't we? And we have our familial definitions of love. And all my family and I, we have a very nice feeling toward each other, and we're willing to do all kinds of things for each other. And familially, that is within the family, that is love. If within the society, the general concept of love is something sexual between a man and a woman, which is not what the Bible is talking about here. So we have to start, if we're going to talk about love as being a test, we have to start by the proper definition of love. What is the proper definition of love? Because right over in the next chapter, Chapter 5 of John, of 1 John, John gives us a definition of what love is. The agape theos. The original language is the agape, which is the love of God, theos. Agape theos, theos being God. The love of God. This is, now this is, you're going to take this from, all the way from John chapter 3, 1 John chapter 3 through to 1 John chapter 5, because this whole section of the Bible is colored by his description of this test, which is love. This is definition, definition, definition. Used to have a radio show I listened to every morning. He would have definitions, word definitions. I guess O'Reilly does that now. At the end of the show, he tries to trick you with a definition of a word that you don't know. Definitions. This is definition love. This is the love of God. Two components. First component, that we keep His commandments. Anything which does not reflect the keeping of God's commandments is not love. Doesn't meet muster on the definition. And it isn't just doing it. That was Old Testament, wasn't it? Old Testament, you had to keep the commandments, but you didn't have to love keeping them. You could hate them, and you were still minimally accepted because you didn't break them. But here he says, they are not grievous to you. You do it because you love them, and you keep them in that way. So the question is, of course, how do we try and test for love? This is a test, isn't it? We're saying love. Test for it. Let's go back and read in 1 John chapter 3. Starting in verse 9. Whoever, scratch yourself from this. Well, scratch me from it. You can judge about yourself. Whosoever is born of God does not commit sin. For his seed remains in him, and he cannot sin because he is born of God. I am here to confess before you that I can sin, and I do sin, and so therefore you must conclude that I am not born of God. You know? And I don't think anybody else is either. But at the resurrection of the dead, if when you are born of God, sin will no longer be a problem for you. In this, the children of God are apparent, manifest, and the children of the devil. Wait a minute. We've got children of God. Or should the children of God be over here? Right hand, left hand, sheep, goats. The children of God are apparent, and the children of the devil. Whosoever does not righteousness is not of God. Neither he that loves not his brother. Jackson the Mason and all of their lives since they were old enough to understand, they've been taught to love each other. I remember how Mark and Georgiana used to teach Brandon and Brittany to love each other, that they were best friends for life. And that's the kind of thing that's being talked about. This is the message you heard from the beginning, verse 11, that we should love one another, not as Cain, who was that wicked man and slew his brother, because his works were evil and his brothers were righteous. Don't marvel if the world hates you. We know we have passed from death into life because we love the brethren. And he that loves not his brother, you are my brother. And I am expected to love you. I don't do it because I have to. I do it because it feels good and because I love doing it. And it reflects the keeping of God's commandments on my part toward you and on your part toward me and toward everybody else in the audience around you. And if it says in verse 15, whosoever hates his brother is a murderer. Hereby we perceive we love God because He laid down His life for us, and we ought to lay down our lives for the brethren. Verse 18, my little children, let us not love in word, neither in tongue, but in deed and in truth. How we teach each other, not how we feel so sweet toward each other, is what is being talked about. Keeping God's commandments toward each and every person within this congregation. That is the love of God. Let us love one another. 1 John chapter 4, verse 7. For love is of God, and everyone that loves is born of God and knows God. Verse 8. He that loves not, knows not God, for God is, one word definition of God, love. Keeping the commandments of God, and that they are not grievous to us. So that's a test. That's a test. It's not an easy test. Now, I gave you five easy tests. This is a hard test. This is one that's hard to use and to spot. There's another one that's also hard. Hard test for us, but it's one that's also important for trying the spirits. And that is God's Holy Spirit in us and in the person? First John chapter 4 and verse 6. We are of God. He that knows God hears us. He that is not of God doesn't hear us. We know the spirit of truth and the spirit of error. Verse 13. Hereby we know that we dwell in Him and He in us because He has given us His Spirit. Hard to understand or to hard test to apply, isn't it? How do we know that God has given us His Spirit? It's got two difficulties. One, we may be too harsh on ourselves in looking at what we expect of ourselves. If God has given us His Spirit, then why did I do that? Hard test, because we say, maybe I don't have God's Spirit. That's the thing to look at and think about. Or maybe we say, because I have God's Spirit, I don't need to do these things. That's something that has as well happened. And it's really, if it's hard for us to spot whether or not God's Spirit is in us, even in ourselves, then it's really a lot harder, isn't it, to try and determine whether it's in other people. So we've had numerous sermons over the last 20 years about unity. Yet we haven't had unity. I do not expect unity. Probably you don't either. Question is, remains, it's sort of a secondary question, I think, are we capable of unity? But I think that's secondary, because John is saying the primary problem here is spirits that come into the church which cause disunity. He says, try the spirits, because many false prophets have gone out. Many false doctrines have come into the churches of God for the express purpose of destroying the church and dividing the church. And it's an ongoing problem. So, Boy Scout motto, be prepared. Be prepared. Luke chapter 22. This is something to think about. It's what Christ said to Peter. He says, watch out, Peter. He says, you are they which have continued with me in my temptations. Christ talking to his disciples there. I appoint unto you a kingdom as my Father has appointed unto me, that you may eat and drink at my table in my kingdom and sit on thrones, judging the 12 tribes of Israel. But then the Lord said to Simon, Simon, watch it. Behold, Satan has desired to have you that he may sift you as wheat. I think that's something we all ought to look at and think about. Not only in the group context, but our own personal individual context. But Christ says, I have prayed for you that your faith fail not. When you are converted, he said to Peter, when you are converted, strengthen your brethren. That's our obligation, isn't it? I'll relate this back to the sermonette that I gave this morning. It's the concluding scriptures. In 1 Peter, chapter 1, verse 7, the trial of your faith. Okay, if you're going to go through this, I just told you, don't expect it to get easy. Now, for some people, this is not what they want to hear. I suspect it isn't what I want to say or hear either. Trial of your faith is much more precious than gold that perishes. Though it be tried with fire, might be found unto praises, honor, and glory at the returning of Jesus Christ. So your faith is being tried with a purpose. Verse 13, wherefore, defensive measure here, gird up your loins, gird up the loins of your mind, be sober, and hope to the end for the grace that is brought unto you at the appearing of the revelation of Jesus Christ. Back to Ephesians chapter 6, verse 14. Stand therefore, having your loins girt about with truth, and having on the breastplate of righteousness.